You're listening to Red Eye on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO at 102.7 FM.
The Vancouver Olympics will bring out the largest military and police presence on Canada's west coast since the end of the Second World War. Over 15,000 highly equipped military police and private security personnel have been engaged to watch over the games. The effect on civil liberties have already been felt throughout the city. But what will happen after the Olympics? Will these systems of surveillance and control leave a sinister legacy of their own? Michael Vaughan of the BC Civil Liberties Association argues that mega events around the world are being used in just such a way. And she spoke last week at the Right to the City Forum, hosted by the Impact on Communities Coalition. Her talk was recorded by Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock.
I'm Michael Vaughan, and I'm going to talk particularly about security, the economy and the budgeting and the concepts of security that we're inheriting here. Now, I participated recently in a conference on security and surveillance scholarship, all of whom were presenting papers on mega events like the Olympics and the World Cup. It is simply an indisputable fact that security spending for mega events is growing. And as you heard Chris say, the latest estimates that we're looking at are approximately $1 billion for the 2010 Games. Mega events like the Olympics are now de facto trade shows for the multi-billion dollar security and military industries. It is also indisputable that one of the usual effects on host cities is the legacy of militarized surveillance and security architecture. CCTV cameras are ones that you probably have already heard of. There's less ink spent on wiretapping, data mining, iris scanning, facial scanning, RFID, that's radio frequency identification chips, satellite imaging, and a range of other technologies. That is, security programs and equipment that would be fiercely resisted and highly controversial without the cover of a mega event, but which can usually be introduced without undue resistance on the grounds of the supposedly extraordinary security challenges of these special mega events. And then, of course, left behind as legacy. In the academic study of mega events, this is simply fact. I myself am not usually challenged on the presentation of this information, except in regards to the characterization of these security changes as militarization. Now, some people say that that term is inflammatory or somehow exaggerated. On the other hand, I am finding that more and more people who only a short time ago would have said that are now finding it an understandably apt term. I see the UN climate change talks in Copenhagen as the alarm bell, which finally sounded loudly enough for almost everyone to hear. 1,000 peaceful protesters preemptively arrested and held without charges, held bound for hours on snow-covered ground or held in cages in warehouses. And everywhere I remember being in the city of Vancouver when this was happening, you could hear the disbelief. You would walk down the street and people would say, hear snatches of conversation, they'd say, in Denmark? Yes, in Denmark. My friends in privacy and surveillance advocacy in the UK and in Europe would tell you, yes, most definitely in Denmark. An eerie echo of the refrain that we keep hearing now regarding the Olympics, yes, in Canada. Mega events like the Olympics and global summits create and leave behind a dangerous authoritarian infrastructure and mindset that tramples citizens' rights in favor of security logic. Now, security logic, as I have said in the past, and I will say again, is a form of insanity. And you're allowed to quote me on that verbatim. Security logic is only ever constrained by available dollars. Security logic tries to address every form of conceivable risk, no matter how remote or actually piebald silly. There is no proportionality to security logic, which is why defense-related spending for fiscal 2010 in the United States is currently budgeted at $1.03 trillion. And why we ourselves are spending approximately $1 billion, and probably counting, for a 2.5-week party, which, according to the VanOck representative at the CBC Public Forum 100-Day Countdown to the Olympics, which I presented at as well as Chris, is not a problem. Because no amount of money, she told us, is too much to spend on the safety of our children and our families. Now, I want to unpack that very, very important thought for just a moment. Now, according to Dan Gardner, who has an excellent book called Risk, Why We Fear the Things We Shouldn't and Put Ourselves in Greater Danger, the risk of us or our children dying in a terrorist attack at the Olympics or no, is somewhere around the risk of being hit by lightning or being hit by an asteroid. The average worldwide death toll from terrorist attacks is 379 deaths. To put that figure in perspective, that's 379 deaths globally out of 6.8 billion. For further perspective to understand what we're talking about in terms of the risk algorithm we're dealing with, in 2003, there were 479 people in the United States alone who died from accidentally suffocating in bed. Now, an objective assessment would indicate that the dangers of sleeping are infinitely greater than the threat of terrorism at the Olympics. But to make matters worse, with all the military apparatus and personnel being imported for what has been called the security games, it is becoming increasingly obvious as we get to the countdown that terrorism is not even actually at the top of the security agenda. So far, what we are seeing is our security dollars truly at work in the suppression of free speech and the intimidation of protesters and activists. This is a very, very important time for us to be thinking about the right to free speech, and in particular, the right to take to the streets with a message. The APEC fiasco stands as a ready reminder to all of us about the constant dangers of the disproportionate use of force in crowd control. And much more recently, we saw the RCMP inappropriately firing plastic bullets, using chemical and irritant weapons on peaceful protesters at Montebello in Quebec in 2007 at the Security and Prosperity Partnership. Now, that's of course what nobody remembers, the Security and Prosperity Partnership for the plastic bullets. Seth is already laughing. That particular summit is famous for having spawned the YouTube sensation of 2007, which was the Agent Provocateur scandal. Do you remember that? There were three undercover officers, at least one of whom was carrying a large rock, and peaceful protesters tried to calm these men down as they threatened to be physically violent and tried to stir the crowd to join them. Three guys were basically unmasked as police officers. The Quebec police initially lied and said that they were not police, but eventually admitted that, yeah, I guess they were. Now, we joined with civil liberties organizations in Quebec in calling for a public inquiry into the actions of police at Montebello. Then Federal Public Safety Minister Stockwell Day dismissed our calls for an inquiry. However, the three undercover officers who were so blatantly trying to incite protesters to attack riot police have been summoned to testify before Quebec's Independent Police Ethics Committee. Now, all of this is 2 years after the fact, mind. And we still don't know what's going to come of those committee hearings. But we do know that we most certainly do not want more of the same tactics at the Olympics. So, the BC Civil Liberties Association has repeatedly called on the ISU, that's the Integrated Security Unit, to guarantee that they will not be using the reprehensible and arguably illegal tactics of agent provocateurs. Eventually, I think it was 10 months and more than one letter, we did get some assurances, but they were not very assuring assurances. The ISU did eventually promise not to provoke citizens into violence. Good. But they refused to promise that their undercover officers won't take over and direct the activities of activist groups. Nor would they promise not to commit any illegal acts themselves. Now, we should find this very, very troubling. This kind of military counter-espionage infiltration agenda ensures that it will be increasingly impossible to believe a word that the police tell us. What kind of democracy do we live in where the public cannot be assured that those speaking out or in favor, in fact, of political issues pertaining to the Olympics are not undercover police officers? Now, there are many cases of mainstream media favoring a general vilification of protesters and comparatively little media reporting of the dangers that protesters themselves encounter. And the top of that list is the risk of unwarranted police action, which may or may not take the form of actually breaking the law, as the police have clarified for us. Now, the failure to convey this to the general public as something that's actually happening is just one component of what appears to be increasing suspicion or even hostility towards citizens who use public space to convey a political message, which in itself is a very intense piece of a much larger ongoing battle over the use of public space that we see in our cities every day. British geographer, a fantastic British geographer named Tim Cresswell, documents resistance to displacement and how often that boils down to a war of characterization. Now, we saw this, I would suggest, most shockingly in the recent Tent City case in Victoria. Now, the legal question in that case was whether or not homeless people who cannot get into a shelter have the right to try to protect themselves from the weather by putting up a tent or a lean-to. Now, the city of Victoria and the province of British Columbia argued that homeless people have no such right. And in their argument, they shamelessly attempted to promote the idea of homelessness as a lifestyle choice. You would see them using the term urban camping, where you would expect to see the normal, sane English usage, sleeping on a sidewalk. Now, happily, the judge in that case, at both levels of court, rejected the implication that many, many homeless people in Victoria are in fact just extreme lifestyle enthusiasts. And eventually that case was re-won again at the Court of Appeal, very, very happily. We're very pleased by that. But this is just one example of how unmoored from basic human decency the battle of characterizations can be. And we very, very much have our jobs cut out for us, trying to get the mainstream media behind the idea that protesters are us and not them, and that we should be seriously concerned that the Vancouver Police Department has purchased a military-grade sonic weapon for crowd control, regardless of their reluctant public promises once this was actually disclosed to the media, to turn off the weapons function for the Olympics. The purchase of such a weapon begs the question, when precisely do the VPD think that a military-grade weapon would be appropriate to use on people in Vancouver? And apparently we won't know the answer to that question until the use of force policy has been developed for this military-grade weapon. This is what I mean when I use the term militarization. And it is increasingly disturbing and apparent that the Olympics is a Trojan horse for this process. And as the spokesperson for the RCMP said in the province newspaper last week, commenting breathlessly on the ISU's command center in Richmond, it's going to be like the counter-terrorist unit in 24. As the UK civil liberties organization State Watch says, there is a new kind of arms race, and all the weapons and surveillance are pointing inwards. Thank you.
That was Michael Vaughan of the BC Civil Liberties Association. She was speaking last week at the Right to the City Forum. The forum was hosted by the Impact on Communities Coalition. The audio you just heard was recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock on Co-op Radio, and we thank Alex very much for his permission to broadcast that.